Live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're at the museum, happy to be here helping break in their new radio studio. On today's Fresh Air, Anna DeVere Smith will perform excerpts of what is perhaps the most original theater piece in New York today, Fires in the Mirror. It's about racial tensions between African Americans and Hasidic Jews in one Brooklyn neighborhood. Also, an accordion performance for people who love the instrument and people who don't love it yet. Forget Lady of Spain, Guy Klusevic will play some catchy avant-garde polkas. And more music from the composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester, who's at the piano. Take it, Joel. First, we have this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Washington power broker Clark Clifford and his law partner Robert Altman pleaded not guilty today to federal and state charges of bank fraud. The two men are accused of accepting bribes and secret loans from the scandal-ridden Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Officials said the two men concealed important information about BCCI's dealings in the United States from federal regulators. The Iran-Contra trial of former CIA official Claire George continued today in Washington. The prosecution's key witness, Alan Fiers, spelled out how George allegedly tried to mislead congressional investigators. John Greenberg reports.
Today's testimony focused on three of the main charges against George, that he tried to obstruct a congressional investigation and ordered his subordinate, Alan Fiers, to do so as well. Fiers was chief of the CIA's Central American Task Force in October 1986. That was the month the Nicaraguan government shot down one of the private planes that flew out of El Salvador to drop arms and other material to the U.S.-backed Contras. Fiers said in preparing testimony for a closed-door Senate hearing, George instructed him to omit any connection between that supply program and an allegedly separate operation to provide humanitarian aid. According to Fiers, George said any reference to humanitarian aid would put the spotlight on Oliver North's operation. Fiers also said George tried to hide the CIA's knowledge of the true identity of a former CIA agent, Felix Rodriguez. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg in Washington.
In an apparent indication of just how seriously he takes the Clinton-Gore threat to his re-election, President Bush has canceled most of his August vacation in Maine. A spokesman said the president will spend only 4 days at his Kennebunkport vacation home, and two of those days he'll be engaged in meetings with Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of Israel. Much of the rest of the time, Mr. Bush is expected to spend campaigning. Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton traveled to Louisiana today, where he continued his attack on White House economic policies. Jim Engster reports.
Clinton returned to the scene where President Bush accepted the Republican nomination 4 years ago, reminding supporters at the Louisiana Superdome of the Bush Read My Lips pledge of no new taxes in 1988. The Arkansas governor contends the Bush administration has made a scapegoat of Congress.
It's amazing. They don't want George Bush to take responsibility for anything that happened in America, but they want to hold their opponents responsible for everything that happened.
Clinton received 70% of the votes in Louisiana on Super Tuesday. He is trying to become the first Democrat to carry the state in a presidential election since another Southern governor, Georgia's Jimmy Carter, accomplished the feat in 1976. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Engster in Baton Rouge.
The Dow Jones Industrials gained 46 points today to close at 3,379. This is NPR. The Bush administration's policy on repatriating Haitian refugees was declared illegal today by a federal appeals court in New York. The court said the U.S. government may not return Haitian boat people to Haiti without first investigating to see whether they're eligible for political asylum. The decision granted an injunction preventing the Coast Guard from returning any refugee whose life or freedom would be threatened. More than 50,000 Jordanians and Palestinians are waiting at the Allenby Bridge to enter the West Bank. They charge that Israel is delaying their entry. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
All Palestinians or Jordanians who wish to visit relatives in the Israeli-occupied territories must cross the Allenby Bridge. Israel processes about 3,000 a day, and tens of thousands have been waiting days in unbearable heat. Palestinians say the situation is deteriorating and causing a huge humanitarian problem. Israeli military officials say they are aware of the problem and are trying to expand facilities to process more visitors. They deny Israel is intentionally making people wait, and they say extensive security checks must be carried out. Officials say they are doing the best they can. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
If the failure of many big savings and loan institutions in recent years seems daunting, the worst may be yet to come. Timothy Ryan, the man who regulates the nation's thrifts, told Congress today that the failure of a thrift the size of Home Fed Bank in San Diego would cost taxpayers as much as $4.5 billion. That's the worst-case scenario, but Ryan told a House Banking Subcommittee that the Home Fed bailout will likely cost at least $2 billion and keeps getting pricier every day. It could be on its way to costing more than the record $2.6 billion spent to rescue depositors of Charles Keating's Lincoln Savings and Loan. Home Fed was the nation's eighth largest thrift, with $13.5 billion in assets. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're live again from the new studio of the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. And the studio is filled with people who've come to watch what they can usually only listen to. With us in the studio is the composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Terry. It's really great to be playing live.
And Joel will be back with us later in the show. And here in New York, perhaps the most original theater performance of the season is Fires in the Mirror. And with us is Anna Deavere Smith, who wrote and performs this one-woman show. It's about racial and ethnic identity. Much of the play is about the tensions between African-Americans and Hasidic Jews in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Crown Heights. Smith tells the story from the perspective of over 20 different characters. Although she is African-American, she inhabits the characters of Hasidic Jews as well as African-Americans. All the characters Smith does are real people. The monologues are adapted from Smith's interviews with the actual people. Anna Deavere Smith, welcome.
Thanks.
To Fresh Air. And, you know, the Crown Heights story that you reconstruct during the play is basically this, and I'll give the real kind of stripped-down version of it. A Hasidic Jew in Crown Heights killed a 7-year-old African-American boy in an auto accident about a year ago. Later that day, in retaliation, a group of blacks stabbed a visiting Hasidic scholar. And there were just incredible racial tensions that have lasted ever since. What about that story made you think that you had to do something on it?
Actually, let me say quickly that the racial tensions
existed
had been
before,
brewing for
yeah.
about 20 years.
Yeah.
So this was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. Probably a bad metaphor for this. But at any rate, I was scheduled this year to create a piece like this based on interviews about Boston. This is a part of a series that I've been developing over 8 years called On the Road, A Search for American Character, where I go places and interview people and try to capture what I call the personality of the place by showing the diversity of its people. And frequently, I'm dealing with controversial event and trying to get varied points of view. And I thought that Boston would be the perfect place to go and do the search for American character, largely because of the amount of American history that's there. I was and am a fellow at the Bunting Institute, which is part of the Radcliffe Harvard community. And however, Crown Heights had happened just before I moved east to take my fellowship. And it seemed to me that it was a real graphic example of the difficulties that we have with difference. I've never been in a community where difference is as obvious and as physical and as material. That is to say that the Jewish people look like Lubavitch.
Yeah, these are the ultra-Orthodox
they're
Jews.
They're one sect of ultra-Orthodox Jews. And the African-Americans there and Caribbean-Americans, you know, obviously identifiable because of the color of their skin, but it's also a community where you can hear Caribbean rhythms. And I was saying that people all wore their roots on their heads. The Hasidim men had yarmulkes, the women had wigs, or the men had fedoras. And in the African and Caribbean American community, you saw dreadlocks, various African head dressings, women with shells in their heads. And I was really stimulated by those obvious differences. I think it takes a lot of guts to wear your roots on your head.
And you went around interviewing people from the Hasidic community and the African American and African Caribbean community,
right.
Caribbean American community,
mm-hmm.
And got their stories, edited what they told you,
right.
And became those people. You
yes.
do over 20 characters. You're going to do a couple of characters for us now. Is there anything else we should know before we hear you do them?
I don't think so. Maybe I'll just say their names and do them, and we could talk a little bit
great,
more.
Great, yeah.
Do you want me to do them both back-to-back,
yeah,
Terry?
Yeah.
Okay, the first one is a young man that I'm doing, by the way, characters that I haven't done on the air very much, and they happen to be both young men under... I think Henry, the first one, is in his early 20s. Henry Rice. I title every selection that I do because I think people speak in poetry, so that these monologues are small poems. I call this one Certain Words. He knew how to use certain words. How to Use Certain Words is the title. And Henry is now working for the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Okay. I knew I was going to have to be elusive, so I went back home and I got my bicycle. And I weaved around trouble. When things broke out, I moved forward. When things calmed down, when things broke out, I moved back. When things calmed down, I moved forward. And I was standing around talking to a group of little kids about voting, the power of the vote. And Richard Green came by and he said, and I said, get away from me, you Uncle Tom. No, I said, go on, get back in your Mercedes-Benz. No, I said that to Clarence Norman. No, I said it to them both. And I was tearing them apart. But Richard Green was very persistent. He said, Mr. Rice, I like the way you speak. He said, I need your help. And, oh! And here in the show, Henry drops his food on it. He says, oh! It didn't get on me. Okay. But he said, I'm a community activist. I need your help. I didn't pay him no mind. But the next day was the day on Albany Avenue when the cops was out there chasing into the black crowd, not chasing into the Jewish crowd, and beating up black kids. And Richard Green came by in a yellow New York transportation van with the yellow lights flashing and a megaphone on the roof, the whole works. And he started calling out my name in the street, you know, Henry, Henry Rice. And at first I tried to ignore it, you know, but he kept on doing it. So I went over to the van and he said, Henry, I need you in this van. He said, come on, ride around with me tonight. Help me get some kids off the street tonight. So I said, okay. He said, the blood of the black man is on your hands tonight. I said, okay. So I get in the van, we're riding around. And I'm talking to the people on the loudspeaker, you know, mothers, please get your children off the street. You know, young people, please go back home. And I began feeling like I had to be there, you know, like the blood of the black man was on my hands tonight. And here he takes another bite of his hamburger. Richard Green, she want to know how to use certain words. Anyway, we get to Albany Avenue, and the cops was chasing these kids up the street. So I jump out the van with the portable megaphone. You know, I'm going like, don't run, and the cops won't hit you. You know, don't run, and the cops won't chase you. Next thing I know, cop comes along, hits me over the head with a stick, and handcuffs me. It takes a megaphone out of my hand. And I'm like, you know, I'm doing a service for the community service for the mayor's office. They didn't want to hear. Matter of fact, they still have that megaphone to this day. So... then I was like, Richard Green, would you come and get me out of this police car, please? So Richard Green came by, black captain came by, said, let him go, they let me go. Back in the van, another brother on the loudspeaker saying, nonviolence, peace. They started throwing rocks and bottles at the van. One young brother was so upset, he came over to the van with a 9mm fully loaded, said, get the hell out of this neighborhood. I told Richard Green, take me on home, shit. Next day, more fires, lootings, and the perception that black youths was going crazy in Crown Heights. Like, they was angry for no reason. So that's Henry Rice. And
you can do one of the
yes,
Hasidic Jewish characters.
Yes, and this is also a young man, 17 years old, Reuven Ostroff, who works as an assistant chaplain in downstate Kings County Hospital, and I call this piece Pogroms. I work as assistant chaplain in downstate Kings County Hospital, and they asked me if Yonkel Rosenbaum had an autopsy, because in the Jewish religion, you're not allowed to have an autopsy, and I found out that he did. And I saw a Jewish man, a Russian man, sitting in a room down by the morgue, and he told me that his mother had committed suicide because she was terrified. And we were sitting in a room down by the morgue trying to get his mother not to have an autopsy. And he told me that his mother had come from Russia because of the hardships there, and that when this thing happened in Crown Heights, it was just too painful. And he said, it's like everywhere you go, there's Jew haters. He said, it's like you're trapped. And he said he woke up in the morning because the doorbell rang, and he went into his mother's room, and the window was open, which he thought was strange, because he was afraid of the cold even in the summertime. And he said he looked out the window, and there was blood all over the pavements, because she had landed, head first, on the concrete side of the apartment building. And the next day, we knew it was really getting serious, because Reverend Al Sharpton came down, Sonny Carson came down, start making pogroms.
One of the things I find really extraordinary about this performance that you do is that you really empathize with each of the characters that you do. At the same time, you have distance on them. And also, I think you find the basic truths and the basic absurdities in each point of view that you present. Is that like an ambition of yours to do that, to be inside and outside at the same time?
That's such a wonderful way. I mean, you're giving such a nice description of it. It wasn't my intent. My intent was to just try to give an accurate document of how someone said something to me in terms of a rhythmic, accurate, verbatim picture. Speech picture. That's all I had in mind. However, I did do a show in San Francisco, in fact, called From the Outside Looking In. And I think as an artist and as a human being, I've frequently seen myself as someone who's on the outside and on the inside and moving back and forth across that line.
I wonder if doing a show like the one you're doing now makes you feel more hopeful or hopeless about people from different ethnic cultures ever comprehending each other. Because the world views of both the African-American and the Hasidic Jewish community are so far apart. And that is so revealed in the piece.
I don't know if I'm hopeful. I'm looking forward. I'm really intellectually excited by the challenge that we have in front of us to find new ways of talking about difference. And I really think that's happening, that people are. And I'm just excited because I think we're going to discover a whole new way to think and be about this.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then I want to talk with you about language and how you use it and your voices. My guest is Anna Deavere Smith, and her one-woman show, Fires in the Mirror, has just been held over at the Public Theater in New York. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anna Deavere Smith and her show Fires in the Mirror, just held over at the Public Theater in New York till August 16th. Now, you've all the characters you do in the show, you interview people, you transcribe what they tell you, and obviously you edit it, because as spoken as your stuff is, I know this from like transcribing interviews myself, that people speak really incoherently. And what you're doing is coherent. So you must really edit it a lot.
No, I try not to, actually. I just try to find a section in the whole interview that will stand on its own. Because once I begin to cut and paste, it takes me away from the through line of their thought, which is what I'm trying to discover by, you know, sort of externally repeating what they've said. And I try to just find a section that I can take out just like it is. Sometimes I can't, because the other thing that I try to do in using, in this case, you know, 29 different selections, is to have a narrative to tell a story. So each character has to push the story forward.
Part of what you're getting at is the way the style of someone's speech, what that has to say about them.
It says everything as far as I'm concerned.
Can I ask you to do just a little bit of, there's a female rapper
right.
that you do in the show, and you really get into her sound, which is everything
right.
in rap.
Right.
And rap is just sound sure. language. So do a little bit of that
Great.
For us and tell us how
okay.
you developed
it. And we call this piece Rhythm and Poetry. I'll just do a segment, a little segment, I'm going into it. So my friends say, well, now, Mo, you know, Miss Mo, since you're so tough and so bad, how come you won't say nothing about Two Live Crew? When I talk about rap, I talk about people demeaning rap. I don't even mention them because they do not understand the fundamentals of rap. I mean, rap is basically broken down is rhythm and poetry, you know. I mean, you know, poetry is expression. You can express anything through poetry. Poetry is intelligence. But if you ain't got a complex rhyme, I'm going to the store. What rhymes with store? More sore for more bore. I'm going to the store. I hope I don't get bored. What you saying, man? Who cares? No, you have to be deaf. D-E-F. Yeah, I guess I had to think of something for you, Terry, that's not slang. Deaf is dope. Dope is live. When you say something's dope, you mean it's the epitome of the experience. And we have to be deaf right now by our very presence because we have to make people happy because we are living in a society where people are not happy with their everyday lives.
That's great. Take us through the process a little bit. You spoke with her on tape, I imagine.
Right.
What happened next? What did you do?
I talked to her on tape. At that time, I was working on a show for the University of Pennsylvania called Gender Bending. And I, at the same time, interviewed a well-known scholar, Houston Baker, who, interestingly enough, writes about rap. And I thought it would be really exciting musically and intellectually to juxtapose his very beautiful academic speech. And he's a brilliant speaker.
But it's very academic.
Monosyllabic vocabulary, as you might imagine, and an incredible facility for repeating details. And he has a lot of information. To juxtapose that rap discussion with Mo. So I took chunks of each of them and put them once against each other, trying to make an overall picture of what rap is. And that's basically what I'm always doing, is looking for segments of a person's speech that I know I'm going to juxtapose with something else. It's either going to be opposite what they're saying, or it's going to create a kind of a collage.
Do you, like, recite along with the person until you get it down? Do you talk along with
the
tape?
In fact, earlier you were talking about transcriptions. I really do a transcription as quite an afterthought. I just take the tape and put my headphones on and repeat what they say over and over again. When I was a young girl, my grandfather used to say to me that if you say a word often enough, it becomes you.
Right.
So that's my strategy.
Now, you have been an actress in other people's productions in addition to doing your own. I believe you were even on a few soap operas. How did you like working with the language, for instance, of soap operas, which I think has to be the most banal of...
I was never very good at it because I was always trying to make more of it than was there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, you have to just be it.
An example of a line you had a struggle with in a soap opera that you couldn't
remember? I can't even think of one.
Okay.
However, on the other hand, when I worked on a play like Joe Turner's Come and Gone, Molly, who's a woman in red, who has a very small part and lines which seemingly... are very simple, I was shocked at how every word had incredible implications. And because, you know, it's really poetry, especially in Joe Turner's Come and Gone, the language. So there's sometimes that what I do, which is taking the what would seem to be the simple language of people and trying to understand the poetry of it, actually helps me when I do the work of some authors.
Now, let's get back to the theme of your show, which is ethnic identity and ethnic differences. Why is that an important issue for you? Did you go through something in your life that made that really resonate?
Well, that's I suppose a long and complicated question. Race is my work. It has become my work. I don't think I necessarily set out to have it be my work. Although, when I was in high school, I knew that I wanted to do something that had to do with people talking to one another, because I grew up in during the civil rights movement. I didn't know what that was. I thought I wanted to be a linguist, and then I found out what linguistics was, and I didn't want to be a linguist. I just knew that I wanted to speak in multiple tongues, and I've eventually left the study of foreign languages, which is what I set out in order to do that. I thought maybe I would be a translator at the UN or something like that, and I find that in English we're ultimately speaking so many different languages that I have quite enough work to do right here.
Right. I've been reading a little bit about you, and I know that at some point, I think your family moved into a predominantly white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably when you were in junior high or something?
Actually, high school, yeah.
That's
actually
a pretty self-conscious period of somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
Did that create any kind of identity crises within you?
I think more shocking was really when I went to an integrated junior high school before we actually moved.
Uh-huh.
And, I don't know if it'd be as shocking now, but when I was growing up, my mother, for example, tells a story of taking me to stores and the people, African Americans couldn't try on the clothes. And the ladies would say things to her like, oh, well, she looks clean. Let's sneak her in. Let me try on the clothes. And my brother, my younger brother has blonde hair and blue eyes. And I have heard several stories of people coming up to my mother and saying, my God, where did you get that pretty little boy? And at first I thought, well, it's all about Diva being so pretty, and now, I'm just holding on to the back of her dress, nobody cares about me. But no, what's interesting about that story, I realize now, is the use of the word get. And I don't know what was going on. And we had a good friend across the street, a very light-skinned boy, whose mother gave him a spanking in a department store. And all of these white women came over and chastised her because I guess they assumed that she was the maid and that this child wasn't her child. So, that's like what I grew up in. And my life's work as a human being has been to resolve much of that and to find a way of living in a society which has different kinds of people.
I'm wondering if being light-skinned African-American has put you kind of in the middle in a way.
Not ultimately. I'm African-American.
Oh, no, I realize that.
I shouldn't say that so quickly, but ultimately I think still some of the same kinds of things play out for me that do for other darker-skinned African-Americans. There is a kind of way that aesthetically I am in the middle, so that when I got out of acting school, the first agent that I ever went to said to me, well, I couldn't possibly send you out because I don't want to offend my clients. They wouldn't know what to do with you.
What are you?
What would you go as?
Wow.
And one agent here in New York who said, I think you should try to pass as Spanish.
Love stories like that. Oh, well.
Aren't they good? Yeah. I haven't had a chance to tell any of those. Thanks, Terry.
So I haven't mentioned, but you're a professor of acting, I believe, at Stanford.
Yeah, I'm an associate professor of drama.
Do you feel like going back to the classroom after this great reception you're having on stage?
Well, first of all, so many of my students have come. And
I've left you about 15 seconds for this answer.
It's so wonderful. But yeah, I think the classroom is the only place still that you can experiment in theater. Really is.
And do you want to perform in anybody else's plays anymore?
Absolutely.
You do? Okay.
I'm waiting for the phone calls on that one.
Well, I'd love to see you in as many contexts as I can. I think the show is absolutely wonderful. Your performance here was terrific. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Anna Deavere Smith's one-person show is called Fires in the Mirror. It's been held over at the Public Theater in New York through August 16th. And then, by the way, she's taking it to Los Angeles in September. To the Mark Tabor Forum?
No. Actually, I'm going in September to do interviews about the riots in L.A. to do a piece, but to ART in September, Fires in the Mirror.
Very good. Okay. Best of luck to you, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, we're live today from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, and our composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester, is with us. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and I'm going to ask Joel Forrester to play us out.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Ain't Nothing But a Polka. Guy Klusevic plays polkas from the fringe and other new music on his accordion. He'll break any stereotypes you may still have of the instrument. And in answer to the questions I'm always asked about the Fresh Air theme, the composer Joel Forrester will tell us the true story of how he wrote it. He's here playing it right now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A federal appeals court has declared the Bush administration's policy of taking Haitian refugees off boats and returning them to Haiti without a hearing illegal. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals issued an order to prevent the U.S. Coast Guard from turning back any refugee whose life or freedom would be threatened. NPR's Margot Adler reports from New York.
It was last May that a coalition of civil rights groups argued in Brooklyn federal court that President Bush's May 23rd executive order was illegal and violated international and domestic law. Lawyers for the Haitians argued that U.S. policy returning Haitian refugees to Haiti created a floating Berlin Wall and that many Haitians were being forced into hiding. U.S. District Judge Sterling Johnson accepted the arguments of the U.S. Solicitor General that the laws cited by the Haitians' attorneys did not apply in international waters. But the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, said today the plain language of the Immigration and Nationality Act states that the U.S. may not return aliens to their persecutors no matter where in the world those actions are taken. Most people expect an appeal, but as yet there was no word whether the administration will now take its case to the Supreme Court. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
A former CIA official told a federal court jury in Washington today that Claire George ordered key information withheld from Congress in connection with the downing of a military supply plane to the Contras. Alan Fire said that George, the former head of CIA spy operations, said he did not want to be the first person to put the spotlight on the White House or the Reagan administration or Oliver North. George is being tried on 3 charges of obstructing Congress and a federal grand jury, and 6 counts of perjury and false statements. Former Secretary of Defense and presidential advisor Clark Clifford has been indicted in New York on criminal charges stemming from the Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal. Gene Brian Johnson of member station WNYC reports.
Clifford and his associate Robert Altman are accused of conspiracy, accepting bribes, and defrauding regulators. The indictments also charge BCCI founder Aga Hassan Abedi and 3 associates with enterprise corruption. Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau said that Clifford and Altman, who were chief executives at First American Bankshares, used legal fees, sham loans, and stock deals in an attempt to disguise the bribes. 2 former BCCI employees have pleaded guilty to criminal conduct regarding the company and are cooperating with the continuing investigation. Federal charges have also been announced in Washington. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Brian Johnson in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 45 points to close at 3,379.19 on volume of more than 275 million shares. Trading today was very heavy. This is NPR News. Former East German leader Erich Honecker is back in Berlin after 17 months in Moscow. He has been arrested, and he now faces trial in connection with the deaths of people who were killed trying to get out of the former communist nation. Honecker, who led East Germany for 18 years until his government was overthrown by pro-democratic forces, is accused of ordering border guards to shoot to kill anyone trying to flee his communist nation. A new study suggests that childhood diabetes may be triggered in some children by drinking cow's milk. Research in this week's New England Journal of Medicine finds that children with diabetes have strong immune system reactions to milk, reactions which could help destroy their insulin-making cells. NPR's Michael Scola reports.
In diabetes, the body's immune defenses go a bit haywire and start killing cells that make the insulin needed to break down sugar. No one knows exactly why that happens. Part of it is genetic. Parents can pass on genes that make a child susceptible to diabetes, but some researchers think cow's milk could be the other part. Here's what they suspect happens. In some babies, the immune system reacts to cow's milk and makes compounds to attack the milk. But these same compounds also recognize and destroy insulin-making cells. In the new study, researchers found many diabetic children do have immune compounds that attack both cow's milk and insulin-making cells. They now plan to withhold dairy products from several thousand infants at risk for the disease to see if that will prevent diabetes. For now, they say there's no reason for parents to stop giving their babies milk. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
In Lebanon, a one-day general strike closed banks, shops, and restaurants in a protest over bad economic conditions. The strike came after the Lebanese currency dropped to near record lows, sending prices soaring. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joel Forrester at the piano. He'll be back with us a little later in the show. Joining us with his accordion is Guy Klisevic. As you probably know, the accordion has mostly broken through its stereotype as the squarest of all instruments. It's now considered hip and eccentric. Guy Klisevic has had a lot to do with that change in image, although being trendy has been about the furthest thing from his mind. Klisevic is not only among today's leading accordion performers, he's one of the most important composers writing for the instrument. He's written polkas, ballads, avant-garde music, and of course, avant-garde polkas. He has a new solo album called Manhattan Cascade on CRI, and he's just returned from a performance in Japan where his album Polka Dots and Laser Beams was recently released. And maybe he'll play a jet lag polka for us. Guy Klisevic, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to have you here.
You actually recently discovered an obscure Duke Ellington polka. Maybe you could tell us how you found it and play us a bit of that.
Sure. Anthony Coleman is one of the composers that was in my Polka from the Fringe collection. And very early on, when I asked him to write a polka for me, he said, you know, Duke Ellington has one, too. And I said, no, I didn't know. And it was written for a piece called the U-Wiss Suite, which was written at the University of Wisconsin in 79. And while he was in Wisconsin, he heard some Frank Yankovic recordings, a Slovenian accordion player, and decided to write a piece for the band while he was in residence there. So he wrote this little piece. I'll play you an excerpt of it.
In addition to, you know, discovering polkas, new ones and traditional ones, you've commissioned a lot of new polkas from various composers. I know what a polka is when I hear it, but if you ask me what it is, I wouldn't be able to describe it. So what is a polka?
Well, a lot of the composers asked me the same question. They had never heard one before. I grew up with Slovenian-American polkas, but there's German polkas, Czech polkas, Tex-Mex polkas, Cajun polkas. What they all have in common is that they're all two steps. And 99% of the time, they're in a major key, and they're sort of fast. And the combination of being fast and in a major key has always given them the impression of being good time music.
You've written a polka. You've written several polkas, but you've written one I'd like you to play now. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us what it's called?
Well, it's called The Grass It Is Blue Ain't Nothing But a Polka.
Is this a bluegrass pun?
It's a bluegrass pun.
For those of us who didn't get the joke.
Exactly, yeah. And let me just, it has a little bit of lyrics in the middle, which I'll just sing you the chorus and then a little that comes after that.
If it ain't got swing. So add a little rhythm, spice up that thing. And there's more, but that's it.
That's great.
I love the idea of writing and commissioning kind of avant-garde polkas and of taking something that had become so corny and making it really new and adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
And you really scared me when you said that there's a chorus. See, my nightmare is to be live on the radio with somebody expecting me to sing along, you know?
No. Yeah. I knew better than that.
You gave me a scare for a second. Now, there's something else I want you to play, and this is a composition of yours. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to give everybody a sense of how kind of versatile you are and what you've been doing with the accordion, which I think very few people have done. This is a really weird piece in the kind of, John Cage tradition?
Yeah, I think John Cage was one of my first influences as a composer. I heard him first when I was a student in the 60s. And I especially liked his pieces from the 30s and 40s that were based on rhythm as being the primary element. And I wrote this little piece called 11 Large Lobsters Loose in the Lobby. And it's based on a dream I had, like many of my pieces. I'm on the road a lot, like most musicians, and have many airport experiences, of course. And I had a dream that we were getting ready to take off for Europe from JFK Airport, and our flight was canceled, and we were put up at a Holiday Inn airport. And as we got to the lobby, the maitre d' de hotel or whatever showed us the first room of a suite that we were to have. And when I walked in the room, there were all kind of lobsters loose in there, and armadillos, and 40 or 50 cats, and an incredible stench. And my first thought, which shows an aspect of my character that I'm not proud to admit, was that I would have to give this room to the guitar player. So I'm a survivor, I guess, but so anyway, that gave me the impetus to write this little rhythmic piece. Lobsters won, you know.
I hope that dream isn't contagious.
No.
Oh, that's a wonderful piece. Well, I really want to talk with you about composing for the accordion and the kind of idiosyncrasies about the instrument that you use in pieces like that, for instance, getting all the wind from the bellows. But first, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back more with accordionist Guy Klusevic. This is Fresh Air. Guy Klusevic is my guest. He has his accordion, and Guy, I want to ask you about composing for the accordion. You've written some pretty far-out stuff for it. Most people think of the accordion as being a very traditional instrument. What is it about the instrument that makes you hear like more far-out avant-garde possibilities?
Well, I had a teacher from the time I was about 8 until I was 18 who actually trained me in violin and piano music transcriptions. And then when I was 16, near the end of my study with him, there was a series of commissions to the American Accordionist Association where they actually commissioned people like Alan Hovhaness and Wallingford Rieger and Virgil Thompson to write pieces for the accordion. And he introduced me to these pieces, and I took to him immediately. And it was funny because that actually was the parting of the ways for us. He was very much of a staunch conservative. And didn't like any music that was written after 1900. And I immediately, at 16 years of age, took to this language. And I think what I liked about the pieces was that they were written directly for the instrument and took advantage of the special characteristics of it. One of the dangers when I ask people to write for me is that they look at the instrument and they think it's a keyboard instrument. And the problem with that is that the bellows change everything.
Mm-hmm. And how do the bellows change everything?
Well, all the breathing comes from the bellows. It's much more like a polyphonic wind instrument. You can play several lines at once, but they all have to breathe at the same time. So the expression all comes from the bellows, which is its great strength. It's also its great limitation because you can't play true independent lines in the left and right hand because at some point you have to change the direction of the bellows and you have to break the phrase in both hands at the same time. So for instance, when I used to play Bach Inventions when I was 16 or 17, you couldn't really play them correctly because he had this wonderful way of overlapping the lines. One line would be ending, but the new melody line would be beginning like a beat and a half before that. And you can't really do that on the accordion because of the bellows.
There's a piece of yours I'd like to hear that, you know, we've heard like far out stuff and polka stuff, but you have a waltz that's mm-hmm. based on a traditional melody that's really very, very beautiful. And it's completely different spirit from what you've played. Mm-hmm. Because time is short, I think I'll have to ask you to play a kind of shorter version of it.
Yeah. It's the name of the piece is Viavi Rose Variations. It's based on a Malagasy tune from Madagascar. And I'll preface it by saying that I listen to a lot of accordion musics from unusual places in the world, unusual in that we don't associate them normally with accordions. I didn't know there was accordion music in Madagascar until I heard a recording. Mm-hmm. And I also listen to a lot of accordion music from Colombia and the Dominican Republic and Brazil and Argentina. And this will also give you an idea of my compositional style because I play the theme literally to this tune, but then I wrote my own B theme, which is a totally contrasting theme that came out of it, and then I present a series of variations on both the original tune and my tune. I'll just give you a little selection. This is the original theme. Variations.
Thank you. really beautiful. That's one of the things I love about you. You know, you could do this far out stuff, and this is really like emotionally moving.
Thank you.
Stuff. Yeah.
I think one of the things that I had to come to terms with about 5 years ago, I used to write very severe minimalist music, and I found out that it limited my means of expression. In literature, there's always been a tradition that the same work of art could be outrageously scatological, very funny, and very serious at the same time, in a lot of James Joyce's work. But in music, there's a real schism between serious music and light music. And so I just tried to open up my musical personality so that I wasn't afraid to be serious, I wasn't afraid to be frivolous, I didn't let that threaten my seriousness as an artist.
Very briefly, because we're just about out of time, do you have any frustrations with the instrument?
Oh, not aesthetically, I don't have any frustrations. It's still very frustrating in terms of the image of it. Everybody wants to know why you play accordion, whereas they don't want to know why you play violin or why you play piano. I do it because I started doing it when I was 6 and I didn't know it was a life decision at the time. Now it would be like taking away an arm or a leg. It's part of, you know, why I get up in the morning and what makes me breathe.
Well, I'm really glad you play it, because you're someone who's made me hear the instrument in a completely different way. And I love your music, and I thank you very much for playing some of it for us. Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And if you want to hear more of Guy Klisevic's music, he has a solo album called Manhattan Cascade that's on CRI Records. And he's got a Japanese import album called Polka Dots and Laser Beams, and that has a lot of polkas on it. And that's a Japanese import, but you can find it in many American record stores. Guy Klisevic, thanks a lot. And Guy's going to stick around. We'll be back a little later. And with us in just 60 seconds will be Joel Forrester to play some music for us. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on Clark Clifford, who was just indicted here in New York?
We will be leading the show with a story on that, the BCCI indictment of the former Secretary of Defense. Mara Liasson is taking a look at the way foreign policy and the campaigns of the two presidential candidates are working together. Tom Gelton will be filing from Geneva on the United Nations meeting on Yugoslav refugees. And we have a story from Colombia that U.S. planes are out helping to look for Pablo Escobar. And we'll also have a story from Eric Weiner on teaching people to speak economics.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Whenever I go anywhere and I meet someone who listens to Fresh Air, they inevitably ask me about the Fresh Air theme. So we've saved some time here to meet the composer, Joel Forrester, who's the co-founder of the Microscopic Septet. You know, when we first asked Joel to write a theme for us, he gave us a theme that we really loved, but it sounded so hard-boiled. It sounded like the show should be called, like, Terry Gross' Private Eye or something, you know? So we said to Joel, can you, like, give us, like, the same theme, but something that would be just, like, slightly less hard-boiled sounding? And Joel's here to explain what he did when we made that request. Joel, can you maybe play us a little bit of the hard-boiled version and the one you came up with afterwards?
Well, yes, Terry, I think explained is a heroic exaggeration. I'm not sure I'll do that. But, you see, my problem as a composer is that I am afraid to be frivolous. I'm sorry, Gay. But anyway, coming out of that, you know, this is what I came up with, as everyone knows. And that's Terry Gross' Private Eye. And she chastised me for it, and to use another word we used earlier, and this is what I came up with. Dig it. Happy?
Yeah. See, we really love both versions. Now, Joel, I know since you wrote the hard-boiled version of the theme,
yes.
You've written another composition that's kind of in that spirit. Maybe you could play that for us.
Well, again, as Terry is a guy, as I'm sure, no doubt aware, composers these days don't really have any ironclad compositional norms to follow. We're not all trailing in the wake of some gigantic recent figure. And one compositional strategy that's contemporary is to listen to one's own music and find some small inspiration in that and allow it to give birth to the next tune. And what Terry's talking about right now is a tune that I wrote a full year afterwards, so that's sort of an elephant's gestation period. I wrote a tune for an all-lesbian circus entitled A Real Circus. May I play it?
Please.
Okay.
Joel, I have to say one of the great pleasures of doing the show live from the Museum of New York is having had you here. It's really been a treat to work with you.
It's
Thanks
been wonderful.
A lot for being with us. And, you know, tomorrow we return to the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. We've had a great time coming to you live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Thanks to our studio audience. Special thanks to everyone at the museum for inviting us to their wonderful new radio studio. Well, let's bring back Guy Klusevic and Joel Forrester to play us out while I thank some of the people who helped make today's show possible.
Terry, you know that Guy and I are both from New Kensington, Pennsylvania, right? Born in the same place?
That's great.
That's true. Nepotism.
Special thanks to Ken Mueller, Chris Catanese, Bill Beam, and Robert Baccia, and the rest of the museum staff. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tui. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Sue Spolin has been our floor director. Roberta Shurrock directed the broadcast. Audrey Vablaitis has been our engineer, assisted by Ron Barron. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Lieutenant Lucy Duvall about being one of the first women street cops in Cleveland and one of the first women in the country to head a vice squad. Now she's the head of the sex crimes unit in Cleveland. Also, writer William Kittredge on the changing American West. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.